UNESCO World Radio Day, 13th of February 2018, and we're talking radio. And is radio still important? I'm with a ham operator, and it's a ham operator is a amateur radio operator, and his name is Justin Bean. How are you doing?
Hello, Brian.
Is radio important today?
Yes, I think it's very important today.
Of course, you would say that, but now you have to back that up with evidence. Why?
Okay, well, it is a method of communication which doesn't rely on the internet. And if radio will continue with battery power, if telephones break down, if the internet breaks down, radio is still there. It uses radio waves that can be bounced. We can use batteries as a power supply.
We think of radio in a first world kind of sense of entertainment and music and something to keep us occupied while we're in the commute in the car. But there's, what, four-fifths of the world who rely on radio for much more than that, for information and availability of commodities and prices and things.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And also in major disaster areas, where in America you'll have hurricanes, you'll have tsunamis, you'll have floods in India, and radio will be a big part of getting relief supplies to the people in need.
And is it amateur radio guys that are keeping the flame lit in terms of experimenting and bringing in new digital modes onto the old analog modes on radio?
I would say yes. It is. The amateur people are very involved in that worldwide, and not only in Ireland. There's a lot of there's new modes coming on all the time. Some very highly qualified and intelligent people are actually inventing new modes on a daily basis, and they're then being released to the population, which are using them in a good way.
Is there any growth in the kind of ham radio clubs around Ireland?
There are some new members coming in. You'll find that a lot of older people are there. More the younger people are more internet radio rather than people of my age group.
Last question, are you picking up much about this software-defined radio stuff? Are you experimenting with that on the receive side?
Okay, have used it once or twice. Very interesting, very good. We worked a special event station from our Coney Day last year, from the Martello Tower in Howth, the museum out there. And yeah, that's a software-defined radio where we both transmit and receive, and made a lot of good contacts with the software-defined radio. It is the way forward, I think, for this type of communication.
That'd be the hurdy-gurdy museum up in Howth, just off Main Street. Look it up on the internet. Marconi Day, I think, is in April.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's April every year, and there's a special event station there every year, EI0MAR.
Give us your own call sign, and thanks very much, Justin Bean.
Thanks, Ryan. I'm EI3CTB.
Over and out. QRT, thank you very much. World Radio Day from UNESCO, and I'm talking with Lara Wright. How are you doing?
How are you, Brian?
Good. Radio, when did you get into it?
I kind of grew up with it because my dad worked in RTE. So from like the day I was born, I was brought up weekends in RTE. He was a sound engineer in there. So I kind of had an interest from an early age because it didn't feel like work because he enjoyed it. And I kind of like going in and seeing all the buttons and lights and things like that. So that's how I got into it.
So you're doing what now in radio?
I am the head of station sound in iRadio. Based in Athlone, so I look after all the promos, imaging, jingles. We don't run standard imaging like liners and sweepers between songs. We brand every single song in our library, so where it's got the imaging built into the start of the song, so the music in theory should flow, so there's no break. So I produce all of that.
Does that make them a bit over kind of identing if they're in every song?
No, because I think if you listen to any radio station anyway, they'll have a sweeper in between, or they should anyway, because it's what differentiates between listening to say an iTunes or a Spotify playlist. You're getting the station brand out there, which is, you know, you've got to kind of keep that at people's because the way people are consuming music, particularly music radio, because everything is so accessible with YouTube, Spotify, they can listen to what they want, when they want. So you have to kind of keep the brand alive by mentioning it every 3 minutes.
Can I exploit this great opportunity? And let's say you're a doctor and I had a sore foot. I'm going to ask you a question in that light. I'm here in front of somebody who does radio imaging, and I have got this pet hate of this kind of swish, bang, wallop, stutter, stutter, stutter type of imaging that particularly 2FM are taken to a degree that really is annoying. What would you say to that?
That's a good one, because I think it depends on the station as well. And 2FM are trying to obviously reduce the age of their demographic, because they, particularly in the Dublin market anyway, they kind of became a little bit irrelevant with the commercials, you know, miles.
6% in the general area.
You know, so the crash bang wallop thing, I do get what you mean, but I think for a CHR station, it is kind of not, I suppose it's the norm globally, you know, and it's just that sound where it kids these days, and even like I'm 36 now, so going back 15 years, you know, everything is fast paced, so that's why they do the stutters and the stammers. So yes, it can be overkill sometimes, but I think if it works, I wouldn't do it on every single song that I do. Like, there has to be a balance there as well, particularly like if, because of the way that JNLR is, it's such a vast age range, like, you know, 15 to 35, like, what I liked when I was 15 is a lot different to what I like now. And, you know, I find myself listening to RT Radio 1 more. I'm turning into my dad as I'm getting older.
Did you hear BBC Radio 1, Vintage Radio 1?
I heard bits and pieces of it. I had planned on recording it the whole weekend, but I kind of dipped in and out of it because there was a lot of stuff that wasn't really relevant to me, like going back to the 60s. I wouldn't have really had that much interest, but I enjoyed things like more from my era when I was like a teenager or in my early 20s, listening to like Mark and Laird and Chris Moyles and, you know, people like that. I also did enjoy the Kenny Everett bits because, you know, way ahead of his time. And when I think of how easy it is for me to edit stuff on a multi-track digital editor, when he was doing all that on, you know, tapes and dubbing and redubbing and, you know, doing all the different voices himself, he must have spent 24 hours a day working on this.
He spent all week just to get that Sunday show together, and wow, did it sound great. Did you hear the imaging of Vintage itself? Wasn't it amazing?
I really liked the fact that they brought John Wells, the American voice, over, who was the voice in the 90s of Radio 1 and 2FM in the late 90s, and the fact that they got him to do all the stuff again, I thought was really good, because it did give it that kind of nostalgic feel where if you grew up listening to that, it brought you straight back to, you know, those days.
In the words of Radio Gaga by Queen, yet to have its final hour, but are their kids gone at this stage, or have they just been stolen by radio stations like iRadio?
I don't know if they're gone. Like, I think there'll always be that element of surprise where you can just turn on the radio and you hear a song and you're like, oh, you know, I haven't heard that in, you know, 6 months. Or like the biggest problem is, I think, the way that the media has gone with the YouTube and the Spotify, and like if I want to listen to whatever song it is, I can just pick up my phone and it's there instantly. I don't have to wait, you know, 2 hours to hear it. Whereas back when I was growing up, if I wanted to hear whatever was in, say, the top 20, I'd have to wait until Tony Fenton was doing the Hotline, you know, at 7 o'clock, and you'd get those 10, 15 songs in that hour. Whereas now you can just pick it up on your phone and get it there instantly.
And is radio grappling with that kind of, what do we do now, kind of, that's the way of the world?
I think it is, and that's why you see an awful lot of stations putting so much time and effort into their social media, like with Facebook and videos, and it's not just about radio anymore, it is really across the board, like all sorts of new media, with the likes of, you know, bringing bands in, recording videos, having them either record and, you know, play out as live, or doing a live recording and then having the video on Facebook and trying to get that interaction with people. But the good thing about it is that it's instant reaction. You're not waiting on the JNLRs every 3 months. You can see what sort of traction you're getting instantly. Like,
but the platforms like Spotify, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they've got the monetization sewn up. There's nothing in it for the radio to actually make money about putting content, their content, their original comedy content, into social.
Yeah, and I remember recently posting something on Facebook myself, which I thought was a bit weird. I think it was Capital in London. I think they were doing, it was either the Spotify chart or the iTunes chart or something. And I was kind of like, why are they basically, I know they're generating revenue off it, but they're also advertising what their main competitor is, you know, like, so, but a friend of mine who's a program controller in a Dublin radio station came back and he was like, if it's revenue, we just need to make the money, so we'll sell to whoever, you know.
Yeah. So listen, the best of luck in the future in iRadio. And any chance you go back on amateur airwaves?
Well, it's 21 years now since I did the license, 97, so I think I was 15 or 16 at the time, and I don't think I've picked up a microphone since then, but I'm sure someday I probably will. Like, I've got gear at home, but I live in an apartment, so it's difficult to get aerials up, but you know, I do have a Yaesu handheld and an iCom mobile rig there, so maybe someday I will get back on.
Thanks very much, Larry.
No problem.
Thanks. For World Radio Day, I'm with Mike Wright. Mike is an engineer of many a year, back through the decades with RTE, and he's telling me he started back in the 60s. Tell us, where did you start?
I started with Radio Caroline North, which was the Caroline ship off the Isle of Man. It came on the air Easter 64, and I joined it in 66. So I was there from 66 to 68, so I was there half of its lifetime. It was on the air for 4 years, and I was there for the last 2 years of it. They had a south ship as well, which was off Frinton in Essex, near Harwich. And so between the two ships, we covered the bulk of the British Isles, you know.
I've heard all the documentaries, and I wasn't there the first time round myself, just missed it, and I would have loved to have been there. But can you answer me this, because I've never really understood this, from the way they tell it through history, and they have a great story, a backstory to tell, but did they distinguish between South and North, or did they just say we're Caroline and they kind of...
No, they did. There was Radio Caroline South and Radio Caroline North, and there were different programmes, different disc jockeys. You had, and then the advertising now, like every day, we used to get a 10.5-inch spool of tape from London, from the office, for each day of the week. And the ads would be broken up into 15-minute segments, so they start off at 6 a.m. in the morning till 8 o'clock. In 15-minute segments, and they were what we call the national ads. They were like Coca-Cola, Findus Fish Fingers, you know, big companies like that that went out on both stations. Then we had local advertising, which was on Cart or Red Live, which would have been casino car sales of Old Swan and Liverpool and places like that. That would have been local advertising to the region that we were covering, you know. So we had a radius of about 150 to 200 miles from the Isle of Man, and the same with the Caroline South ship, you know. So we were nearly down as far as Birmingham, you know.
When Irish people heard Caroline, they were hearing Caroline North.
Yeah. How,
and what sort of kilowatts were you pushing in those days?
When I joined it, it was 10 kilowatts. And shortly after I joined, in late 66, we upped the power to 20 kilowatts. Now, Caroline South, again, started off with 10 kilowatts in 64. But in late 65, or late 64, Radio London came along, which was an American-backed operation that anchored a mile away from Caroline South with 50 kilowatts. So they took a lot of the audience away from Caroline because, well, they were a much slicker station because they had this American style about them, and they had the much higher power as well. So they put a far greater, stronger signal into London and the south of England and also onto the continent. So Caroline South eventually, in 66, upped the power to 50 kilowatts to compete with our nearest neighbour, you know. And we only went to 20 kilowatts when we changed frequency because, again, we were originally on 199 metres, right, on the medium wave, which was the top end of the medium wave. Radio London was in roughly in the middle, around 266 metres. When Caroline upped the power to 50 kilowatts, they moved frequency to be close on the dial to Radio London. And we then moved frequency as well to be close to Caroline South because we only transmitted from 6 in the morning till 8 in the evening, but Caroline South was 24 hours a day. And with radio propagation, as it got dark, the signal from the south ship travelled much further, and you could hear it here in Ireland and in Dublin and the north of England. So there was no point in the two of us being on, you know. So that's how that came about.
It's difficult operating on the water away from land and the surety and safety was there dangerous moments?
Yes, well, of all the ships, the one that I was on, the MV Caroline, which was originally the Fredericia, which was a small Danish passenger ship to Danish islands, it was about 800 or 900 tons and about 200 foot long, and it was the largest of all this, of all those offshore stations, you know. So we had a decent sort of ship, where the likes of Radio Scotland now, that was on an old Irish light vessel, which is only 100 foot long, a very small one, you know, and that used to bop around the water like nobody's business, where we all had our own cabins as well because it was a small passenger ship. Caroline South was a smaller ship, but you had to share cabins, and bunks as well with different people depending on what time you were on at. But no, our ship was fairly stable, and we were anchored in Ramsey Bay, so we were shielded from the westerly winds. And there was a few bad storms when I was there. The worst one, trying to remember now when it would have been, I think it would have been early 67, January 67, when the highest gales at that time ever recorded on the Irish Sea was a force 12, which was a hurricane. And part of our aerial system broke and we were off the air for 3 days with it. But that was the worst weather we ever had. But you couldn't do anything. You were being tossed all over the place. You couldn't cook anything even, because pots and things wouldn't stay in the cooker, you know. So you couldn't sleep because you were rolling up and down in the bunk or the bed, you know. So,
do you listen to Caroline North on 1368 for the retro weekends, the memory weekends?
Yes, sometimes from Manx Radio. Yes, I have heard that, and it has been pretty good, you know. And it was good to see the present day Caroline getting a license, albeit only fairly low power. But whether it'll be a success or not, I do not know. If they kept the format of the Caroline North thing that the Manx Radio thing were doing, I'd say it would be a huge success. But they seem to want to go with a more modern type of formatting of music and stuff like that, and for that reason they're going to sound just the same as any other local radio station, you know. And they all sound the same. It doesn't matter where you go on the dial, you can't tell one from the other, you know, because they're all playing more or less the same music and they all sound very alike.
I think we're being shifted out of here for my final question then, and I think I know where this is going, but they're all sounding the same. What should they do to differentiate?
It's hard to know, really. I really don't know. You see, they're chasing. In the Caroline thing wasn't chasing money, you know. They're all chasing money now, and there's too many of them because the pot isn't big enough, you know. In the days of Caroline, it was done because there were no music stations that we know of today. And it certainly changed broadcasting in Europe. But I really don't know where it'll go from here, you know. I can't see them all succeeding. They're all owned by one or two, certainly in the UK anyway, one or two companies. And for that reason, it doesn't give them any competition between each other to make them sound better than the fella next door, you know.
Mike Wright, thank you very much for your time, and happy World Radio Day. And
thank you too.
World Radio Day 2018, and I'm with Rory Hinchy. Hi, Rory.
Good afternoon, Brian.
When did you first get involved in radio?
Well, my first involvement in radio has been through many varieties and guises. It was initially in looking into community radio back in the late 1980s, and around the same time I was just finishing up with college and got involved with amateur radio, which is an interesting outlook. I knew very little about it at the time, but it gives an opportunity for ordinary individuals to operate their own transmitters, receivers on various different frequencies, both locally and far and worldwide.
Is radio suffering an image problem in terms of, you know, it fitting in and being important in the world that we're in? I'll tell a little story about how I know you, and you would have brought me into the world of the World Wide Web in 1994 with HTML and servers and all that kind of stuff. That's now 24 years old, that stuff, and it's got Spotify and YouTube and everything, and radio is kind of less important to the kids nowadays. Has it got a problem fitting in?
Radio is facing a changing dilemma. As you rightly described there, the world of radio as was known in the late 1980s has changed, both from a broadcasting perspective, where everybody listened to it on a fairly regular basis for their entertainment, their music radio. These days we have the ease of hard disk type media, memory players, you know, where you're not actually needing to tune into anything. You've also got the Spotify versions of things, but even getting people interested in amateur radio can be quite challenging because it's not seen as so exciting. Remember, back in the day in the late 1980s, early 1990s, mobile telephony wasn't so common. You didn't have your phone to be able to ring someone up. So being able to have a walkie-talkie or a CB radio to talk to your friends or to talk to your wife or whatever was a very useful tool. That particular interest in using radio to talk to people around the world is no longer there, because you can use the internet by email, by blogs. All that connectivity is happening in a different way. In terms of broadcast radio, so that's where change occurs there. In terms of every form of radio, though, it turns around. We can take the same form of radio is your mobile phone. that is giving that. So in a sense, the use of radio has changed. So many more people have access to have a radio type device in their hand and have that communication using radio. And we have the World Wide Web, which is, be it a wired communications means, is also, at least it's getting people communicating, and it's the a useful way of exchanging information around the world. It's changed the way that young people want to use communications tools.
You've put it very well, because Spectrum is used for mobile, and mobile is the popular use for people browsing on the Dart or the bus, and they're using it. Is there still that kind of old Spectrum limitation issue?
Spectrum is a challenge across the board, even now, but in a different way. I don't quite know what you're thinking of in terms of spectrum limitation, but there's always a case of finding new frequencies for things. As the years have gone by, we've seen the initial starting off around the 900 megahertz band for mobile telephony, moving from analog to digital, and then further frequency bands being added. And every time at ITU-type conferences, there's always a look for more frequency bands, higher frequencies. At present, the big talking point in terms of frequencies to get for 5G, which is perceived to be Internet of Things data, lots of data being sent around the thing, around everywhere, high-speed connectivity for everyone to their internet. Frequencies as high as 26 gigahertz are being put as sort of the norm, and where people are looking at, is there a possibility of, you know, 42 gigahertz, 60 something gigahertz, way up in that sort of realm. There's always a movement to try and find more frequencies to accommodate the kind of communication that people want to do. It may not be so much focused now on voice, it's maybe more focused on data using the IP formats, but taking even that as it stands, Wi-Fi, which was your sort of license exempt computer frequencies used back 20 years ago maybe, that's may be used with your smartphone now to enable Wi-Fi calling on certain phones and on certain networks, so that you don't necessarily have to have your cellular radio connection. You could perhaps use a local Wi-Fi network to connect to have your voice call. So in a sense, you can turn one to the other, but it's a different type of use. It's just marking how technologies are changing and ever-changing all the time as the demands change.
Final question, is there a case to be made that when parts of the spectrum are deregulated, like Internet of Things in the 480 megahertz kind of thing, and there's, you know, a particular type of use, but you don't have to be licensed for it, is there a case to be made that advances radio because it gets to be used quite a lot without a lot of paperwork going into regulators?
There's a lot of calls for having unlicensed spectrum requirements will arise on regulatory authorities on a constant basis. The likes of PMR 446, which was a UHF sort of walkie-talkie arrangement which everybody could get and use themselves, that is one version of it. But we've got the Wi-Fi bands, which started off initially at 2.4 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz. The people want more spectrum for that to enable this wireless connectivity for data. It's still a means of communication. And in terms of people who think radio and work radio, it is a form of radio. We just have to wait and see where it goes to. It's maybe not the same radio as we knew it 30, 40 years ago, but it is using radio, and that in itself, if you're in the technologies to build radio circuits, it's still something for you to be doing.
Okay, so I'll just finish with a comment and say that as radio is heading towards light and the rainbow frequencies, the future's bright for radio.
Well, it's a little while for radio to get quite towards light, but we're always looking upwards, and it may get there in the next 100 years. We'll see what another 100 years of radio can bring us.
Rory Henshey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.